This is an ABC podcast.
Hospitals can be scary places. The bright lights, the jarring sounds, metal instruments and beeping machines. And sometimes, of course, the cries from patients in terrible pain. Think how much worse all that must be for kids. And this is what Dr. Catherine Crock became conscious of when she began working in hospitals in Melbourne in the 1990s. She decided there had to be a better, kinder way to care for patients. And right at the heart of the approach she developed was music. Hi, Catherine.
Hello, Sarah. Nice to meet you.
You too. Let's start with music. What kind of music was heard at your house growing up?
Look, mostly classical music, I'd say. My mum played the piano and she made sure that all of us five children learned music of some description. And in fact, we had a piano teacher who would come to the house and she'd start at 3:30 in the afternoon. She'd teach everybody. She'd have a dinner break in the middle. And I think it was great. We were just surrounded by music. We all then went on to do different instruments, not in a professional way, but so we'd have cello and clarinet and oboes and all sorts of other instruments in the house. And it was great.
Would you play together, you know, with a bunch of siblings? Did you ever play all together?
We did. We had a little family orchestra. It was probably fairly painful for the people who had to sit and listen to us, but we really loved it.
And when would you play? Was it special occasions or what got the family orchestra tuned up?
We would get tuned up for special family Christmas concerts and we'd invite the neighbours and friends in for that. And if anyone was any good at singing, they could come and take up the vocal parts.
And is that a tradition you've continued with your own kids, Catherine?
Yes, look, we did. So as my kids were growing up, they started learning instruments as well. And the next generation of these Christmas concerts would happen. They've pretty much stopped for the time being. And part of that was one day we were playing all our Christmas repertoire and I'd have to admit I didn't have much time to practice. And our eldest son, Ben, turned to me and he said, "Mum, you are terribly out of tune." And I thought maybe it's time to put the oboe away because I'm doing too many other things.
It's like, give me a break, son. You know, I'm a medical doctor. I'm a professor. I'm trying to improve patient care. I may not be in tune on my oboe.
Exactly. And part of it is that I don't really like performing. And so being in that setting, I would get a bit nervous. And when you're nervous, as oboe players would know, your mouth tightens up and you become quite sharp.
You're first in line of five children. Are you the cliche eldest sibling, Catherine?
I think so. The others might say I was a bit bossy, but certainly I always liked to be doing the right thing. I think I made it fairly easy for Mum and Dad. So I think that's what can happen to first children. You want to, you know, be good and do the right thing and make sure that your parents approve of you.
What did your parents do for work?
Both of them did medicine, and my dad was an orthopaedic surgeon, ran the Department of Orthopaedics at St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne for many years, and Mum was his surgical assistant through most of the time that we were growing up. So back in those days, it was pretty much impossible for Mum to have a career of her own and have five children. But the two of them worked in this beautiful partnership that was really fantastic. So Dad would do the surgery and Mum would do a lot of the aftercare of the patients.
She's a big dancer too, your mum.
Well, Mum was an Irish dance champion as a child. She can still do the Irish dancing, but she moved into tango in her later years. So from the time she was about 60, I think she started tango lessons. And now she's in the advanced class and it's been quite amazing. She comes to some of our events and she has demonstrated her tango in hospital events where we like to bring the arts along.
Fantastic. What kind of people would your dad bring home from work when you were growing up to join your family for dinner?
Well, that was really interesting. And I think we just thought it was normal. But the hospital carpenter who might do repairs at the hospital, he became a close friend of the family. Lots of the nursing staff, certainly professors and people holding high positions at the hospital. But to Dad, everybody was the same, really. And so he found everybody interesting. He had a curiosity about people that meant they would all come to the dinner table.
What would you do with your dad on a Saturday morning?
Look, this was a special time for me, Saturday mornings. Dad was so busy. If you wanted to spend time with him, I would go on his ward rounds and we'd walk through the wards at St. Vincent's Hospital. And I just loved the way everybody we met as we went through the hospital. Dad knew them all. He knew them by name. He treated everyone with kindness and respect. And it was such a great atmosphere, and he worked in a really good team.
What did the patients think of you, little Catherine, trotting along with the doctor?
It never really occurred to me. I think they were quite touched by it, probably. But I was, certainly adoring Dad and just following him along and listening to everything that was going on. And we'd come home with big arms of vegetables and flowers and things that the patients and the families would give to Dad.
How did he think about his vocation as a doctor, do you think? Did he talk about what it was that was motivating him to work in the places that he did or with the patients that he did?
I think for him it was the idea that he wanted to be helping people and that he wanted to use the education that he'd been given. His parents had to work pretty hard to be able to get him to medical school, and I think he wanted to pay that back. And he was always very devoted to being kind to other people and to helping them.
So was there a moment when you were there on those ward rounds or listening to the conversation at the dining room table that you decided that you wanted to pursue medicine yourself?
Look, it's really Mum who's reminded me that I would have been about 12 when I started to say, I'm going to do medicine. So I never varied from that the whole time. I just headed towards it from then on.
And was it always children in particular that you wanted to work with?
No, that came a bit later. So I started, I went through the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne as a Monash medical student and then went into adult medicine initially and the blood area, so into haematology. And I'd got about 4 years into that when I had this realisation I'd like to go and see what it was like working with children. And that really changed the direction of what I wanted to do, because when I got to the Royal Children's, I thought this is just amazing and very special and this is where I want to be.
When you were working as a physician at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, there were children there who were being treated for leukaemia and other cancers. What tests do those patients have to undergo regularly?
So when a child is diagnosed with leukemia, they need to have bone marrow tests to help us work out what type of leukemia it is and what treatment they're going to need. And a bone marrow is taken a little bit like a blood test, but from the back of their pelvis, where we can extract some of the bone marrow and then look at it under the microscope and do some special tests and work out what exactly is going on. The other thing we need to do is a lumbar puncture test. So one of the places that leukemia can hide in the system or can relapse is in the spinal fluid that protects your spine and your brain. And so we need to have a look every time the children come. So take a sample of the spinal fluid and look at that down the microscope and put some chemotherapy direct into the spinal fluid to protect their spine.
How do you take a sample of spinal fluid?
You use a very small needle and just position it very carefully in the right spot and you'll get the fluid out. We only take a tiny amount. We need about 1 mil of fluid to be able to process it and to work out what's going on. But these children will have 30 to 50 of these procedures over maybe a 3-year course of treatment. So it's quite a long journey.
And when you were first there, Catherine, what sort of room was this happening in where these children were having this procedure?
We had a treatment room that the children would come to each week when they had these procedures done. Now, sometimes it was quite distressing for the children. We had a little bit of sedation medicine that we could give them, but I was really worried at the time in those early days that what we were doing in the way of pain management wasn't quite cutting it, because sometimes the children would be distressed by what we were doing. And I knew that if they got distressed the first and the second time, it actually built up and it became more of an issue to them as they went further along in the treatment. And I'd also say, I think as a young mother, so I had, my children were from seven down to one when I started doing that job. I thought if this was happening to my children, it would be really hard to deal with, and I wanted to make it different. I wanted to make it better.
Were parents of those kids encouraged to be there with their children while they were having that procedure?
Yes, they were. So the parents would be with us in the room and they'd be helping us to calm the child and soothe the child. And it was some of those parents back in those days who I actually started talking about the journey with and saying, what do you think we could do to improve this journey for you and your child? Because certainly it was distressing for the children, but it was also really hard for the parents to be in that room and to be having to help us to calm their child. It's pretty difficult.
And what sort of things did those parents tell you, Catherine?
It was fascinating, Sarah. So we sat down and we talked through the whole journey, and they would tell me, one, that the pain management really could be done better, and that the occasions when their child had needed to go to the operating theatre and to go fully asleep for some other procedure, and we'd come along and done the bone marrow at the same time, that was such an easy way to have it done. They also talked about various efficiencies in the hospital. It's quite amazing what families will notice when they're the ones on the receiving end. So at one stage, they said things like, you know, we wait for hours and hours for clinic appointments. Couldn't something be done like in those days, give us a pager and we could take the pager like a pizza buzzer and go to the park with our child and we'll come back when you need us, instead of sitting waiting in the plastic chair until you're ready for us. They really were pointing out we could treat them with more respect. Respect their time.
What did they tell you about the noises that they were hearing, both inside the hospital room and coming from outside?
Look, families find it quite overwhelming and like a cacophony. A hospital is a very noisy place, as you said at the very beginning. There are so many sounds and sights and things that are going on that actually raise your anxiety level when you're in there. And I think they're often more obvious to people coming from outside than they are to us who've been in it every day, day after day, week after week, year after year. And so it was quite refreshing to have parents say, just listen to this. You know, this is really difficult for us and it makes us feel quite anxious.
Even the noise of the bins outside was something that parents brought up with you. Was that something you were conscious of, hearing bins being collected by the rubbish truck outside the hospital?
Oh, it was even more than that, Sarah. This was the rubbish bins in the patients' rooms. One of the parents said to me one day, did you realise that they empty the rubbish bins at 11 o'clock at night?
In the rooms?
So in the rooms. We've had a really busy day. We've just got settled. You know, we're coming to terms with how getting our child off to sleep in the hospital, and someone empties the rubbish bin in the room. Now, that's all well and good, but learning that sort of information from the families is so important for us to be able to make changes to the system, because we can't know all that. Even the hospital CEO can't know all of that. But to be able to feed that information back in and then go, oh, well, we could easily alter the timing of the collection of the rubbish.
Of course, that's not an expensive change or a huge systematic change. It's something that's both very simple but really profound.
Yes, and I loved that. What I was hearing from the families wasn't in any way a criticism or a complaint about the hospital system, but just saying, hey, we've noticed this and we think if you brought in this change, it may well help a lot of people's journey.
So Once you'd had these conversations with parents, I guess the next step was to talk to your colleagues and other members of the hospital staff. How did those conversations go?
Some of them went really well, and people would just go, oh, look, we can help with that. Things like the oncology parents were pretty concerned about taking their child into areas where they might be susceptible to infections. So they've got low blood counts. We've suppressed their white cells that fight infection with the treatment that they're being given. And in the clinic room, we'd say, be very careful and don't expose your children to too many things. And then we'd write a slip that was for pathology and say, take this down to pathology, where they might sit for a good hour and a half with 53 other children who've got coughs and colds and diarrhea. The parents' brilliant idea was, why can't we take these blood tests for the oncology children in a different area where we're all a little bit more safe? So some of the practical things like that, I found that the pathology department just picked it up and ran with it. You know, that was easy.
Were there any staff, Catherine, who thought, look, this isn't our concern. Hospitals are tough places. Being sick is hard work, and we got to focus on our surgery and on our, you know, our examining of patients. We don't have time for all this sort of soft and fuzzy stuff around the edges.
Look, definitely for me, there were some hard times, and I had some colleagues who thought I was actually stirring the families up and making them complain. Now, as I said to you, it was not a complaint session at all. It was a constructive feedback and a let's bring the families in as part of the system so that they can help us improve. And I did find that pretty hard. I potentially was a bit naive and thinking everyone is going to just jump on board with these changes and think it's great. But for some people, obviously, the status quo, everything seems to be working. And if you're not listening to the perspective of the patients and families, you can well and truly think it's all going fine.
How did you first come upon the idea of music and of using music in the hospital setting?
That was through some of these discussions with the parents. And I mean, I was aware of music in my life and that it was missing when I came into work. But the parents also, when they talked about that harsh environment and the harsh sounds, that really made me think, okay, we could do something about that and it shouldn't be too threatening to the system. My children were learning from professional musicians at the time, so players in the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. And so I thought, well, I'll use their expertise. I'll bring them in and see what they think about the environment and whether they've got some good suggestions. And that was really quite a big change. It was really amazing to bring composers into hospital spaces. And what we started to do was bring them into a waiting room and they could talk to the families, they could experience what that waiting area was like. And then they even came through into the operating theatres and could hear all those noises that were going on. And when a creative, artistic person who really understands sound comes in there, they can find it pretty challenging. So Tony Gould was one of our jazz composers who came in, and Tony felt it was a life-changing experience for him to be in this environment. Matthew Heinsohn's another of the incredible Australian composers who said once he'd really immersed himself in that hospital environment, he's composed subtly differently from that day on.
In what sort of way? How did it change the way he composed?
Because it has had him focused very much on what's the purpose of the music. So it's not music for entertainment or for the background. This is music that needs to serve a purpose for people who are in a really stressful, potentially dark place. And so I think he felt a big responsibility to do this really well and to do it differently. And into the future, he's kept that in mind whenever he's been composing.
So you actually started requesting new compositions from these musicians to play in the hospital, is that right?
Yes, look, that came about when I happened to meet Paul Grabowski, who's an incredible Australian jazz composer. And Paul approached me and he'd heard about what I was doing with music and he said, I would love to compose for this. Paul had had experience in the hospital system himself, and so he said he understands. He had the music in his head and he really wanted to get it down on paper and on the piano. So it was Paul who then guided me and introduced me to a lot of the other composers and musicians who over the last 20 years have composed for what is the Hush Project.
And what kind of music do composers come up with to be played in that very particular setting? As you say, it's not entertainment, it's not background, it's a really special setting. What's the music on Hush sound like?
Look, it's very varied. And in the beginning, we thought maybe it needs to be just lullaby, you know, very soft lullaby music to put children off to sleep. In fact, it can be very sophisticated music and often where some sort of a classical and jazz overlap. We've done some vocals. We've actually invited children to be part of it. So asking children what they think and what lyrics they would like. And we've had children help write Hush Volume 16, A Piece of Quiet. So it's very varied. And what we find is music that's interesting and engages your mind and takes you to another place rather than just saying we want to put you off to sleep.
Back in the early days, Catherine, when you first started introducing music into the hospital, how did people react, both patients and staff? What did you observe about the impact it had?
It was a little bit of an unusual thing to do, and I think people were curious about that and thought it was quite interesting. At first, I had one CD to play in my own operating theatre, and I had people popping in all the time and saying, "This is really gorgeous. Could we get hold of this?" And so my children would be burning copies on the CD burner and I'd be handing them out.
Was that what was that CD? What was that music?
That was classical music. So that was the first, which was really reimagined classical music played by a beautiful trio. And, became really popular. And then I approached Australia Post and I talked to them about maybe being able to sell these to raise some money to keep the project going. And it was a very small thing, but actually took off in Australia Post because in those days they weren't selling other music in the
post offices. You had a Vietnamese family whose four-year-old son was being treated for leukemia. Tell me about that family and how they responded to the music.
I might explain to you that when children have leukemia and at the very beginning of their journey, they need to come to us every week and come through the operating theatre for those bone marrow tests and lumbar punctures while we're getting the start of the treatment underway. And they come for the first 4 weeks and then they're going to have a month off. This Vietnamese family didn't speak much English at all. And so we'd talked through the whole system with them, with the interpreter, and explained to them, come each week for these procedures and then you can come back again a month later at the end. I went out into the waiting room 5 weeks into their treatment and they were sitting in the waiting room and they shouldn't have been there. So I called the interpreter and I thought, we need to explain this again. I haven't explained it properly the first time.
They've turned up when they don't need to be here, you're thinking?
They turned up the week that they didn't need to be there. We explained it all and the dad just said, Thong only came to hear the music. So he had found the environment that we had built a safe and a comfortable enough place that he would even come on his day off. So that was marvellous.
Must have been a pretty extraordinary kind of feedback to think people coming voluntarily to the hospital, it was such a welcoming or peaceful environment to be in.
Yes, and that isn't only about the music. It's about the way our team has really focused on what's going to help every individual child and family and how do we tailor that journey to make it the best we can.
You're moving even beyond music now. How is virtual reality technology a tool being used to help kids while they're undergoing treatments?
Well, this is fairly new, as you'd realise. And I've been involved in a project where they're looking at virtual reality goggles that have got really interesting underwater scenes and little stories, and children, well, even adults as well, can put on the virtual reality goggles. They've got the hush music in the background while they're looking at the scene. And it can be things like, we need to do a blood test on a child, and it will be an underwater story where there are little fish that come nibbling at the child's hand while they're sitting there with the goggles on. And we're getting really good results that this is actually improving their experience when they need to have some small procedures done.
Even with the very latest technology and all of your skills and the skills of your staff, procedures don't always go as hoped, and patients don't always make it. That's of course true for children as well as for adults. What's your way of coping as a team when that happens?
What our team really needs to do is to come back together and do a debrief and talk that through and check in with each other that everyone is actually coping. I think this is becoming more and more obvious in healthcare, but it's not the way we used to do it.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Catherine, Cape Patterson is somewhere that has long been a special place for you. When did you first go there?
When we were medical students, one of my classmates, his parents had a place down at Inverloch, and so groups of students would go there and we would have a wonderful time. And Cape Patterson being nearby was one of the places we'd visit. My sister Liz was involved in that too. She was part of our friendship group. And many years ago, in the early 80s, Liz actually bought a place at Cape Patterson, and that gave us a family connection that's continued to this day.
What did it look like in the 80s when you arrived there? What was the moment that really struck you as like, I'm here, I can see this before me?
It's when you come around the corner at Kilcunda and you see the ocean for the first time. It's spread out in front of you and you get this enormous view of the coastline going on, heading towards Wilson's Prom. And that's when, yes, you let out a breath and you think, this is beautiful. This is where I like to be.
What happened in 2009, Catherine, when you were visiting Cape Patterson with your sister?
Yes, well, that was a little bit unfortunate in 2009 and was quite a blow to me. I ended up with some heart problems. And as it often happens, just when you've gone on holidays, you've had a really busy year, you're just relaxing for the first time in ages. And I started to drop my pulse rate down to about 35, which is particularly uncomfortable.
So could you feel, what were the symptoms that you were feeling in your body?
Very faint and lightheaded. And I'd been cleaning out the fridge when we got to Cape Patterson and using some liquid ammonia. And I thought, well, it must be that. But actually, it was something more difficult. It was a heart problem.
How did you realise? Was it you as the medico who was self-aware enough to know that something was up?
No, not at all. I'm not a very self-aware medico. I tend to deny that there's anything the matter with me. It was my sister, Carmel, who is an emergency physician, and Carmel took my pulse and she said, your pulse is 35, we're going to hospital. And she bundled me into the car and we ended up at Bass Coast Health in Wonthaggi, who looked after me absolutely superbly and put me in a helicopter to Melbourne to have a pacemaker put in.
Do you remember that helicopter ride?
They put you in headphones, the big headphones, so you can't hear the helicopter, I think, because as a patient, it's very noisy in the back of that helicopter and quite scary. Yes, I do remember it, but it's quite a quick trip from the coast up into Melbourne in a helicopter.
How confronting was it to go from being the doctor in charge to suddenly this very vulnerable place of being a patient in the midst of an emergency?
Extremely confronting. And I'd always been really fit and active and had never had any previous health problems. So this hit me like a ton of bricks. And it took quite some time to come to terms with it. I had some very close friends who looked after me through that time. One who told me it was absolutely fine if I wanted to cry for 2 weeks.
And did you?
Yes, I did. She is a friend who's got a nursing background, and she basically took me to her place and fed me and looked after me and made sure I looked after myself a bit better. And then another friend who said, would you like to come and do some mosaics at my place?
Mosaics? Why mosaics?
It was something that my friend Amaryl had been doing for a long time. And she set up a table in her backyard with all of these bits of tiles and tile cutters and glue and things. And I could just go there and basically zone out and do something artistic that really took my mind off everything else that was happening.
I love this, crying and mosaics. Like, neither of them are things you can get off a prescription, but clearly they were really important in you healing.
Absolutely. And yeah, it was interesting that it needed somebody else to say it to me. I wasn't in a state to be able to think of that myself.
Did you have to get the surgery for the pacemaker straight away, Catherine? What's the sort of time lag?
Straight away, within 24 hours.
And whereabouts was that put in your chest, and what kind of implication did that have?
So they put a small, like a battery box, underneath your skin, underneath your collarbone. And that just sits there. You get the battery changed about every 10 years. What I've found with that is, unfortunately, it's not in a great position for me, because we do a lot of bushwalking and hiking, and the placement of the battery is right under where I have to carry the strap of a heavy backpack. So I've had to make some adjustments in that when we're hiking, to be careful that it's not rubbing and uncomfortable.
Could it have gone somewhere else medically, or did it have to be in that exact spot?
That's a really good question, and I think I'm going to have to ask my cardiologist about that. But yes, I think there is some variability about where you can put it, and possibly next time we have a battery change, we could talk about moving it to somewhere. I don't think it would be a problem for everybody. It depends what your activities are, I guess.
I suppose that's an example that what happens to our bodies in hospitals, in surgery, of course, has consequences of how we use our bodies on the outside world that are going to vary from person to person, that it's not self-contained within the surgical space, what happens to our bodies.
Yes, exactly. And from my own work, we're very conscious when we're putting in central lines and things in the children of how that's going to impact on how they can function and whether they can get on and keep playing and doing the things that they want to do. So where you might put a drip or where you might put some other surgical implant, it's really important to think about that person's lifestyle.
When you came out of the anaesthetic after that surgery for the pacemaker, Catherine, what did a nurse ask you?
Oh, look, I'd been pretty stressed by this whole journey and I guess relieved when I came into recovery. And this beautiful nurse came up to me and she said, would you like a tea or coffee? And I said, oh, I'd love a coffee. Is it real coffee?
You are a Melbourne doctor after all.
That's right. For me, it needed to be a real coffee. And she said, look, a little bit busy at the moment, just you wait and I'll get you a real coffee. And she went down to the cafeteria and came back with a proper coffee for me. And that act of kindness actually counteracted so much of the other things that had happened in the lead up to this particular thing. And I would say for that nurse, she might not have thought about it again, but to me, it made a huge difference.
That sort of spontaneous act of kindness from that nurse, which, as you say, was so meaningful to you, is there any way that that can be, well, it can't really be mandated, can it? But is there ways it can be supported within a big bureaucracy, a big organisation like a hospital?
Look, I absolutely think there is. And I think that the leadership in hospitals is now coming to realise that if they can give staff the space and the time in their day and the trust that they can be doing something that is really good and worthwhile. that staff will bring these acts of kindness forward and they'll make a huge difference. So we need to be promoting it and expecting that you'll be able to do that in your workplace and you're not going to get into trouble for doing it.
So is kindness just the way that some people are nice, some people are kind? Is that what you're talking about, Catherine?
Look, that's important, but really I'm talking about something way more vital and important from a patient safety and a staff safety point of view. If we're not treating each other as staff in hospitals with kindness and respect, we actually don't have the bandwidth to treat the patients and families the way they need to be treated. We can lose important information in the system if we feel like we're under pressure and our colleagues are not treating us well. And I think it's important for everybody who's working in the system to think about this and realise the importance of respectful relationships that can really help us to close all the gaps and make sure that nothing goes wrong.
So kindness isn't just a sort of add-on, it's actually something fundamental to the system working well.
Absolutely fundamental. And I think COVID has shone a light on this and meant we really have to think about those relationships so that we can sustain a good teamwork when we're under such pressure.
The way you want to encourage patient-centred healthcare, you haven't just communicated it through emails or conference papers, Catherine. How else have you tried to get this message across?
Look, I don't think I'm that good at conference papers and academic journals and things. And what I do love is the arts. So I've tried to bring the arts as a different way to have people having these conversations and to start to think a little bit differently about our healthcare culture. So in 2011, I met Alan Hopgood, who's an extraordinary Australian playwright. And I put to Alan this idea that he could write us a play built around the stories from patients and staff about experiences in hospital and also the stories of patients where things might have gone well or they might have gone badly. I think at first Alan was a little bit surprised. He had done a couple of health plays prior to me meeting him, and that's really why I contacted him. And he'd done a play about his own journey with prostate cancer. This was something different. This wasn't about a disease or a condition or something. It was more about the relationships and the communication that goes on behind the scenes. So he wrote this play, Hear Me, and we started performing it in 2012. We've done over 200 performances around the country and internationally. It's been quite an extraordinary way to talk about healthcare culture, because it can light up a room. It's just amazing. We put the play on very simply staged. We don't really need sets or costumes or anything. It's more about the dialogue and the stories. The play runs for about half an hour and we might be in a hospital or the auditorium or a seminar room, sometimes even a tea room or the cafeteria. And staff and patients come to the plays. After we've seen the drama unfold, we then discuss some of the themes with the audience, and that's where it can get really interesting to hear what the culture is like in that organisation, the things that go on behind the scenes, and getting the staff voice about what they think we could do differently and better.
What are some of the more surprising things you've heard in those conversations?
Look, we've definitely heard from trainee doctors who talk about feeling unsafe when they need to ring their senior staff or consultants at nighttime, that they might get shouted at. And I certainly know in 1982, I was shouted at by a consultant in the middle of the night. And thinking about it from the trainee's point of view, you've actually put a lot of effort into making that phone call and feeling brave enough to ring someone and wake them, and then they get cross with you for not having all the right information. It's actually not a great way for the trainee doctors to learn. So at one of the hospitals where we heard that this was a problem with some of the consultants, the CEO was in the audience and said, well, I think we should be recording these phone calls for education and training purposes. So an actual change came out of the drama being put on in the hospital and giving people the the space to then talk about the issues openly. And sometimes these are the hard things to talk about.
I know you love Kate Patterson, Catherine, but it does seem to be slightly injurious to your health. You had another brush of mortality there while you were waiting for a tow truck at your sister's place. What happened that time?
Well, I was standing on the driveway at her house, getting her car towed into Wonthaggi to get it repaired, when I was stung by a jack jumper bull ant.
What's a jack jumper bull ant?
They're very interesting. They're the most toxic insects in the insect world. They're distinctly Australian, uniquely Australian ant. Lots of people would recognise them, I think. They're a small bull ant with an orange sort of bitey mouthpieces at the front, and they don't walk like a normal ant. They actually jump, and they can jump out of trees. They can jump off hose fittings or whatever, and they give quite a nasty sting. About 3% of the population can have an anaphylactic reaction to the sting of a jack jumper, and I was one of them.
So you were there waiting. Did you see this ant bite you, or you felt it? Did you know what had happened?
Oh, yes. It's like a bull ant sting. It's like fire going through your foot. And as that ant was biting me, I looked down and there were two more hanging off the bottom of my jeans, and I gave them a swipe and they stung me as well. So I'd actually got a triple dose of ant in that moment, and I knew within 30 seconds that I was getting really sick.
So what did you do?
Without really thinking it through, I jumped in the car and I drove to Wonthaggi Hospital, where they resuscitated me after I staggered in the front door. So once again, Bass Coast Health.
Shout out for saving Dr. Catherine. Was that a safe thing to do? Like, was speed the essence? Did you just have to get there as quickly as you could, or should you have waited for an ambulance?
Speed was of the essence. I knew that if I called an ambulance, I was reasonably remote, that I may not have been alive when an ambulance got there.
So what were you told after having such a strong allergic reaction to these ants? What advice were you given about how to coexist with them?
I became pretty worried about being anywhere out in the bush or outside of metropolitan Melbourne, because the ants are anywhere. I had to carry an EpiPen at all times, and we had to teach the family how to use them and make sure that everybody would be able to resuscitate me if need be. And then I was lucky enough to get on a desensitisation program, which I now still attend at Monash Medical Centre. Every 3 months I get a small dose of jack jumper.
Wait a minute. How does that work? What's the desensitisation program? It sounds like something that might happen in North Korea. How does it apply to jumping ants?
The idea is to desensitise your immune system so it doesn't overreact when you meet the ant toxic protein. And it's like bee desensitization or peanuts or any of those other allergies that you might get. And the idea is that you get tiny, tiny doses that just bump your immunity up enough to keep you safe. So in the beginning, I was getting increasing doses of ant venom every week for a few weeks. And now I just get a standard dose every 3 months.
And do you have a reaction to those doses?
Just a slightly itchy arm these days. I haven't ever had a big reaction again.
Has that allowed you to go forth back into the bush and back to Kate Patterson?
Yes, it has. So gone are the days where I have to wear a hat and long sleeves and tape my gumboots to my jeans so they can't drop in my gumboots. It's much better being free now.
Last year, Catherine, amidst all of the lockdowns in Melbourne, you found yourself back in hospital. What happened?
Well, through last year, I started to have some gut problems. Now, I've never had any problems with what I could eat or anything like that. And I started getting tummy pains and diarrhea and just didn't feel good. But with us all being in lockdown, and I knew I was stressed and everybody was stressed, I think I avoided getting proper medical care. And this is something that we have noticed through COVID, that people preferred to stay home and think, I'll just wait this out. But by this time last year, I was really very sick and ended up with bowel surgery because of diverticulitis and an abscess that burst. So that was quite a lesson to me about listening to my own body and actually getting help when I need it.
As someone who has paid so much attention over their career to enhancing a patient's experience in the hospital setting, what was it like being in hospital during COVID?
Very scary and unsettling. And of course, everybody's in masks. I could only have one visitor for an hour each day. And it was very isolating. So it was very hard. And I think what I found important was those small acts of kindness from the nursing staff and the people who were allowed to come in and give you some care. The cleaning staff and the catering staff, you know, you actually really look out for their visits when they come in, and they treat you as a person. They make you feel okay, you know, oh, you haven't been able to eat this meal today. Could I try and get you something else? Would maybe some yogurt work? Those sort of things, you cannot underestimate how important they are.
Did you listen to music while you were there as a patient?
Well, Sarah, of course I did. A friend of mine gave me a boombox and I attached up my phone with all of my Hush music. And of course, we now have 18 hours of this most beautiful music, and I know every note of it. So for me, it's very comforting and makes me feel really safe to have that on. And I think hospital at night is a difficult place. You've got pain, you're not sleeping well, you're not comfortable in the bed, etc. And to have this amazing music in the background took me through many a night, which was great.
Nights are longer in hospital somehow, aren't they? They shove in a couple of extra hours whenever you're in a hospital in the nighttime.
Yes, I'm not sure how they do that. And they also make some pretty weird noises, those hospitals at night.
As you described earlier, you were introduced to mosaics and making mosaics after you were recovering from having your pacemaker installed. Who did you introduce to mosaics in your own family?
Well, that was my dad. In his later years, Dad started to lose his memory and have some problems with dementia. And we'd always been really close. And I just thought maybe that was something that we could do together. And really, the outcome of it wouldn't matter that much. What we came up with wasn't the purpose. It was more that we could spend time together. So Dad and I started doing mosaics. And it was really interesting, Sarah, because he'd been an orthopedic surgeon, so he could reconstruct the most amazing three-dimensional parts of people's bodies. And he did anatomy atlases and beautiful books, etc. And even when he couldn't remember who we all were as his family members, he could still do incredible designs with coloured glass in the mosaics. And it was really special to sit and do that with him.
How did he help create gifts for Hush, for the Hush Foundation?
In 2014, we took on a very large project for Hush. We decided after 14 years of music, it would be wonderful if we could do like a retrospective of all the music that we'd done and bring together the composers from all of those years. It was 88 musicians and composers who were involved in a concert that we did at the Robert Blackwood Hall in Melbourne. And when the Hush team were deciding, how are we going to say thank you to all of these people who are putting on this incredible concert for us to help the Hush Foundation, one of the team said, wouldn't it be lovely if Harry Kroc could do some mosaics? So I went home to Dad and I said, look, we've got this project. We'd like to make gifts for all the musicians. Dad got right into it. We had little blocks of wood for him and he did some beautiful coloured glass. Every single one was different for the 88 musicians and the 22 behind the scenes Hush team who were putting on this concert. And Dad sat at the concert and handed out to each of them this gift that he'd made. When we got home that night, he said, that could have been the best idea we ever had. And the 6 months in the lead up to the concert, every day it got Dad out of bed, to start doing his mosaics. And if someone would visit the house, they would sit with him for an hour or so, and they would help to glue pieces of glass on there and just sit quietly together. And it was quite an amazing project.
I guess that it kind of connects to the way so many people have discovered or rediscovered jigsaws under a lockdown. It's an activity with someone that allows silence as well as conversation.
Yes, and it's so soothing. And I think your mosaics are like that. You're trying to pick which colour is going to go with the next colour and how do the pieces fit together. It's quite meditative, really.
Where do you do mosaics at your place now, Catherine? Do you have a special spot?
At the kitchen table, usually, which can be fairly annoying because if it's an ongoing project, it can take up a fair bit of space and it makes a reasonable amount of mess. But the family's just learnt to work around me.
What are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm doing a 2-metre-high weedy sea dragon made out of sea glass that I've collected off the beach.
Why a weedy sea dragon?
Well, it's the emblem of Victoria, so I thought that that would be quite fitting. I've previously done a seahorse, which is the emblem of Cape Patterson. So that was the first of these large pieces made out of sea glass, and now it's the turn of the weedy sea dragon.
And where will this weedy sea dragon live once you've completed it?
It'll be an outdoor piece, so we'll put that up on the wall.
Beautiful. Just when you were speaking right at the beginning about those formative experiences of being with your father on the ward rounds and watching the way he interacted with patients and with everyone involved in the hospital, the carpenters, the cleaners. How do you trace his influence on the life that you've built and the work that you've done over that career?
I think it's been really influential, and I think about Dad and the way he treated people pretty much every day, particularly at work. There have been times, though, when it's been disappointing that the system that I've ended up working in is not the system that I dreamt about and the system that Dad seemed to work in. I think that's given me the passion to try and change it and to bring more humanity back to what we're doing. I'm very aware through putting on the plays about the bullying and the hierarchy and the risk-averse health system that we're in that can make it difficult for people to treat each other as they really should. And so for me, the idea that we could shift towards a kind system that's kind to the people doing the work, kind to the people receiving the care, makes a lot of sense.
It's really lovely to speak with you, Catherine, and hear about the work you've done. Thank you, and are doing. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
That's a pleasure, Sarah. Lovely to meet you.
And that's from Hush Volume 19, Tony Gould and Quiet. Dr. Catherine Crock was my guest on Conversations today. Catherine is the chair and founder of the Hush Foundation. And we'll put a link to that organisation at the Conversations website. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
On days like these, we want to tell you the best story you've heard all week. Each episode of the podcast, we speak to one person about the biggest day of their life, the moment when everything changed. And there's always something you didn't see coming. Days Like These has funny stories.
And he looks beautiful. He's fat and juicy and looking lovingly at the photographers.
Scary stories.
I came to when I was being dragged to a police car.
And everything in between.
I just felt so wrong to leave her there.
And that's when I freaked out. I can't stay in this place. This is terrifying.
And he said, oh my God. Yes.
And in our latest season, we bring you tales of a mysterious Brumby, a brush with the Polish secret police, one woman's dream to earn her trucking license, and the power of an illicit love song. Join us on Days Like These. New episodes drop each Wednesday morning, or catch up anytime you like on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.